And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Glad to be with you again here from Austin, Texas, being heard around the world through the, well, I guess we call it a miracle of internet and radio. We're on, of course, powerofprophecy.com 24/7. So if you have insomnia, just get up and listen again. Some folks listen to this program several times, and I'm glad that they do. Today is a program you're going to want to hear more than once. Of course, you can always order a CD or audio tape of this program. We'll tell you how to do that later. But most of all, you're going to want the book that we offer today, because the guest is going to tell you why you should have the book. Now, I don't think his goal in life is selling books, but my goal in life is getting the truth out and distributed to people. And I suspect that he shares in that goal. So again, it's great to be with you here on powerofprophecy.com and, of course, American Voice Network Radio. And we also have a WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio, out of Nashville, being beamed by shortwave across, well, the universe, I suppose. It never stops. I don't know when it fades out through the galaxies or something. Maybe the little Martians from Mars and Venus are listening to it somewhere. They say those waves go. I don't know. That's scientific stuff. Today we're going to get into much more than science, although it is reality. You know, Michael Collins Piper has been a guest of this program before. So most of you know Michael, or many of you do. We've offered his books. I love the one about the Golem, G-O-L-E-M. Oh, my. That really is one of my favorite books. And, of course, he's got the New Jerusalem. So many books. Really, I think he wrote a book that has the answer to the John F. Kennedy assassination called Final Judgment. Very, very interesting book of hundreds and hundreds of written on the JFK association. Assassination. My words are getting, you know, Jerry, I think you're just finally hitting up with me, you know. I don't know, my old age or something. I don't know, though. Maybe not. Maybe God will allow me a few more years of mental clearness, let's just call it. Of course, some people think I've been crazy from the beginning. So what is it? What does it really matter? Okay. Well, the name of this book, and I've asked Michael Collins Piper to come on again, is The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme. Now, first of all, Michael Collins Piper, in addition to those books, is an ace writer and reporter, investigator, whatever you want to call it, for American Free Press. That's a newspaper that I love. It's a weekly. You can get a subscription to it, and listen, you will want a subscription to American Free Press. I get it, read it cover to cover. Every week it comes. It's one of those you really can't put down. There's always going to be something of interest in the American Free Press. Willis Carto is the publisher. There is no more honest and intelligent and brave men in this world than Willis Carto. And I can tell you that he numbers many enemies in this world. In other words, if you've made a lot of enemies, probably you're doing what's right. On the other hand, he has a lot of people that love his work, that counteract those the bad sorts that don't like the truth getting out. So you always keep that into account. And Michael Collins Piper is like that. You either love him or you hate him. Now, we love him, and many other people do too. And that's why, because he tells the truth. Michael, welcome back to Power Prophecy.
Tex, it's a pleasure to be on this program. I have occasion to cite your work all the time and refer people to powerofprophecy.com, because while there are a lot of people out there broadcasting and writing, the volume of what you do is voluminous in many ways. You speak out, and you speak out loudly and proudly for what you believe in, and you produce an extraordinary volume of material covering so many issues. I have marveled at your catalog. Both Willis Carto and I, in fact, have personally together marveled at your output, the volume of what you've done and the good work that you've done. So it's always a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners. And I have over the years gotten quite a few letters from people who have said, hey, I heard about you from Tex Mars. So I know there's people out there who are definitely listening to PowerOfProphecy.com.
Well, thank you for those kind words. Really more generous than I deserve, but I'm going to take them from Michael Collins Piper.
Problem with that, yeah.
That's right. Hang them on the wall or something for posterity. Now, this book, to me, is so very important. On the front cover, and I'm going to ask you about that cover, it says, Inside the Rothschild Empire, the Modern-Day Pharisees. Now, I love this painting, but I've got to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, they're sitting around in some boardroom or something, these big-shot tycoons or whatever, all kinds of people. There's a donkey there. There's a sword. But they're these headless people, too. And I thought, wow, does the book tell us who the headless people are?
You know, it's interesting because I had seen this. Actually, this picture that's on the cover of the book is a 1926 painting by a German artist named George Grosch. I think that's how it's pronounced. It's spelled G-R-O-S-Z, and it's entitled Eclipse of the Sun.
Hmm.
Now, what's interesting about this painting, for those who haven't seen it, and you can actually look on the internet and you can find it there, this painting was portraying the corruption of the Weimar Republic that held force in Germany after World War One, and you know what it shows this someone who looks like a corrupt plutocrat with some machine guns and weapons under his arm, whispering in the ear of an aristocratic looking military type man, and then you see these headless people sitting around the table. They're well dressed. They look like corporate types, businessmen, diplomats. And then you see this donkey, an ass, with blinders over his eyes.
Yeah, just notice that. The donkey has blinders on his eyes.
And I thought that this painting, although it was supposed to capture the corruption of the Weimar Republic, you know, as I put in the New Babylon, I said it's really hardly any different from what we have in America today, where we have these powerful financial interests. And in this case, in the book, we talk about the Rothschild Empire. I call them the modern-day Pharisees. They are the plutocratic interests, the big money, global big money interests who are whispering in the ears of the politicians, the headless politicians. You might call them the brainless politicians. And I just thought that was such a provocative image. It's both provocative and yet mysterious.
You know, it really
is. And it makes you kind of wonder who these people are and what they represent. You know, what goes through the mind of one artist isn't necessarily what goes through the mind of another. So there's probably all sorts of secret cryptology here that I'm unaware of. But on the whole, I think it does represent, as I say, to bring it full circle, what we have going on in the United States and around the world today. I mean, a lot of people know about the mass media and the corruption within the mass media. A lot of people know about the corruption rampant in the whole Federal Reserve System. But what a lot of people don't connect, a lot of people don't make the connection between the fact that the very same people who own the Federal Reserve are also the very same people who control the big media in America, the big print publications, the big, you know, the weekly magazines, the big daily newspapers, not to mention, of course, the broadcast media, the real powerful force in our world today. It's a very small group of people, and it's getting increasingly smaller, who are standing astride this whole complex. And they are the ones who have the power in our world today, and not just here in the United States, but increasingly throughout the world. And it all stems back, and that's the point of this book. It not only reaches back to the Rothschild Empire that has been sitting in place in Europe and is worth untold, I'm sure, trillions of dollars when it's all added up in the end of our days. Trillions of dollars, but it goes much further back. While people like to talk about the New World Order, a lot of people try to avoid what I believe is the absolute solid fact that can be documented, and I think is documented, to the satisfaction of many people, that the what I call the historical, religious, and economic origins of the New World Order go back even further than the Rothschild Empire, but go back to the teachings of the Jewish rabbis beginning in the days of Babylon, where they started to formulate the Jewish religious teachings that we today know of as the Talmud. And essentially, they taught then, those rabbis speaking among one another in these Jewish rules and regulations for all intents and purposes that were codified by the Talmud and ultimately more set in place through further analysis, so to speak, and commentary by other great Jewish religious figures. This whole process laid forth an idea, but also a formula such that if carried through to its ultimate conclusion, would lead to what one writer has described as a Jewish utopia, a world in which all the riches, all the power, the media, the glamour, the glory would fall into the hands of the Jewish people. And you know, while some people will say that's all well and good, the problem is that if you start analyzing so many of these teachings, you find that they are rooted in a very real hostility towards non-Jews, and in particular, Christians.
Mm.
And so there we have to step back and say, okay, well, they dream of a world in the hands of the Jewish people in which they speak very openly, of which they speak very openly of. But the question is, will this new Babylon be of benefit to all of the people of the world? And I don't see it being that way. And that's why I wrote this book.
All right, now going back to Babylon, what you said makes so much sense, Michael, because let's face it, God prophesied that the Jews, because of their wickedness in Israel, the prophet Jeremiah, you can find this in the Old Testament, prophesied that Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon would take them captive and destroy so many of the people and destroy Jerusalem and the temple. And he did exactly that. Babylon came in, took the Israeli people, let's just say the predecessors of the Jews, and I don't want to get into all the, we could talk for hours about who is a Jew and what is a Jew.
Oh, absolutely.
But what we do know is that those rabbis then were taken captive in Babylon, and they stayed there at least 70 years in captivity. So they took their evil, devilish, man-made religion. You see, if they had stayed with the Old Testament, that would have been fine, but they didn't. So they took what they had, this evil that God punished them and sent them to Babylon. But when they were there, instead of correcting their activity and turning back to God that they should have, what they did was to say, hey, these Babylonians have things we like. They have practices, rituals, satanic things that we like. And we love, of course, all the money and the wealth that's here in ancient Babylon. So they really combined Babylonianism with their Phariseeism. You might say their wicked religion. And that became Phariseeism, I should say. So then when they finally did return to Israel, it wasn't Mosaic religion, wasn't the Old Testament. It was simply Satanism through the prism of Babylon in Egypt, wasn't it?
Well, you know, that's the amazing thing about it. You know, the average person, Christian or otherwise, if you ask them if they have any opinion at all about the captivity of the Jews in Babylon, as it's known, most people would say, oh, well, that was another period in which the poor Jews were oppressed and suppressed and held as slaves to another. But, you know, in fact, what happened was when they were officially freed from their captivity in Babylon, many of the Jews who were, quote-unquote, in captivity chose to remain there, number one. Number two, even during their period of so-called captivity, even Jewish historians will honestly record, openly record, that actually the Jews achieved immense power and influence and money, even while they were officially in captivity there. In fact, it's no coincidence that one of the wealthiest and most influential Jewish families in the world today, the Zilka family, and that's spelled Z-H-I-L-K-A, I believe, or actually let me check my own writings on that because I can never remember how to spell that name, but it's a name people need to know, Zilka. It's Z-I-L-K-H-A. The Zilkas were born in modern-day Iraq, and that, of course, is basically Babylon. Their roots, and they are one of the wealthiest, most Jewish, wealthiest Jewish families in the world. They have been interconnected with the Rothschild Empire for centuries. They trace their roots and their wealth back to Babylon.
Mm.
And you know, people have heard the Rothschild name, but most people have never heard of the Zilkas. And, you know, the point that I make in the New Babylon, and I have it broken down into several chapters, which I think will help people kind of understand the framework that I'm talking about here. I include the Zilkas among what I call the 30 most powerful Jewish families. You know, there are a lot of families in the global network. So I shouldn't say the 30 most powerful, but they are among the most powerful families in the Rothschild court, so to speak. You know, you have some very, very big names, and then there's like secondary and third level tiers of influence, and the Zilkas are among these high levels. These names most people have never heard of. They might be known in their particular communities in America, but ultimately they are part of this New World Order network, this Jewish utopia network that all is interconnected, interrelated on a very personal and intimate basis between the Rothschild family, its financial dynasty, and all these tentacles that reach throughout these families and the financial interests that are interconnected with them. So that's what I say. I use this one name, Zilka, as an example. But there are so many other names that I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with.
So, in other words,
very wealthy families, mm-hmm. They're very powerful families, and they have their networks of their own, but ultimately it comes back like, you know, compare it to the head of an octopus. At the head of that octopus is the Rothschild dynasty. That's a simple way of putting it, but I think it's largely an accurate way of putting it.
It's interesting.
I'll just say one more thing in that regard, Tex. The Rothschild family was not the first great Jewish banking family. There were Jewish banking families that arose throughout Europe, you know, and reaching even into Asia. You know, going back to the Middle Ages, you know, at a period when, you know, contrary to, and I've done a lot of research on this, and, you know, I could, if I had all the material in front of me, I could cite it, but actually, you know, a lot of the times that we hear about how the Jews were being persecuted throughout history, like, for example, during the Middle Ages, actually, I've read some Jewish historians who say that actually, in some respects, the Jews had a lot more freedom during the Middle Ages than the non-Jews did.
Mm.
And during that time frame is when many of them started to accumulate a lot of money. What happened then in the years that followed, in the centuries that followed, Jewish families became the court Jews, so to speak. That's what they called them. That's not my terminology. Jewish families became advisors to the kings and made money operating in the sphere of the kings. And then it turned out the Jews had accumulated an extraordinary amount of money. While the kings were the rulers of the land, the great purses were held by the court Jews. And these court Jews, as time passed on, they developed into an international network. Well, ultimately, from this international network, there arose Meyer Rothschild. Now, his real name apparently was Bauer, and the name Rothschild means red shield. He took that name from a symbolic sign outside his banking house. But Meyer Rothschild, in the late 1700s, sent his five sons throughout the capitals of Europe to establish branches of their banking dynasty. And within about 25 or 30 years, the Rothschilds had risen to the very top. There were other powerful Jewish banking families. I think the Goldschmidts and the Montefiores in England and the Bleichroders in Germany. And, you know, the list goes on and on. But ultimately, the Rothschilds rose to the top, and they at different times by different people were referred to as the kings of the Jews or even the kings of the kings. And ultimately, all of these other banking enterprises, these banking families, became part and parcel of this global far-reaching global network in the hands of the Rothschild dynasty. And, of course, I don't want to keep going on here, Tex, but I'll throw out one more point, let you talk a little bit here. But what happened was that as a consequence of the rise of the House of Rothschild, they became particularly interconnected with the British Empire, what came to be known as the British Empire. And in many respects, the British Empire, although it was grandly ruled over by great kings and queens, and it was, of course, the American mother country, the British Empire, in many respects, was the central point of financial power for the Rothschild Empire. The Rothschild banking house in London was like kind of like the grand central station of the whole big Rothschild railroad that ran around the world. Mm. And ultimately, as I say in the New Babylon, much of that Rothschild power, not surprisingly, came to be transferred to the United States as the United States began to develop. So this is all the kind of stuff that I explore in the New Babylon.
So Lord Jacob Rothschild, the fourth Baron over in Great Britain, so he may be the big shot, but we have other Rothschilds in the United States, in France, Belgium, in other countries then.
Oh, it's quite an extended family, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you took us all the way back to ancient Babylon, and when you know, I was thinking as you were talking about how the Jews, in what they call the diaspora, you know, their, you know, nomadic existence, without really having a nation of their own, through the last 1900 years or so. But you mentioned the fact that in each nation, through their cunning, their craftiness, and no doubt through their corruption, and their nepotism, their favoritism of their own bloodline, they were able to amass a huge amount of money. And so even in those countries where they claimed to be persecuted, they actually were favored quite often, and because of their banking and money, they were actually favored, and they weren't that poor. They were persecuted possibly because of the corrupt manner that they behaved in. But I was thinking back as you were talking, Babylon is a perfect example of that, isn't it? I mean, Daniel was Jewish, or Israelite, let's just say. He was of Israel, yet he rose up to become the second leader in the whole nation, or the whole empire of Babylon.
You know, that's an interesting point you make, Tex, because, you know, this book, The New Babylon, is a considerably enlarged and expanded upon earlier book that I wrote called The New Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, The New Jerusalem, I focused specifically on, or I should say, I focused on the specific aspects of Zionist Jewish power in America, citing largely Jewish sources. I would say probably about 99.9% of my sources were respectable mainstream Jewish sources. And I had a lot of people come to me and say, my goodness, I knew that the Jewish people had a lot of power in America, but I never realized how much power. Well, you know, in the New Jerusalem, I made a point. The point I made, I had selected that title, The New Jerusalem, because I was saying that in many respects, the United States had become the New Jerusalem.
Mm.
But the more I thought about it, I even made a passing reference in the book to the possibility that maybe we might not want to call the United States the New Jerusalem. Maybe in light of how life is today in America, we might want to call it the New Babylon. And then I began to think, well, yes, what we're talking about, Zionist power in America, has a history that goes back to Babylon. It goes back to this thing we call the Talmud. It goes back to this dream of Jewish worldwide utopia. And, you know, as I say, it's generally known today as the New World Order, but its origins indeed go back that far.
Well,
and that's why we have to look at it in the bigger historical context. We can talk all we want about the New World Order. And there's a lot of people who will say, well, the New World Order has its origins in the Illuminati. And I say, well, to people, well, yes, you're absolutely right. There is this Illuminist context. There is this Freemasonic linkage towards what we're talking about. But ultimately, when you see the actual organization of it, the physical organization of it, and I want to draw a distinction there, the the framework upon which it was established, the political framework that we have in existence now, stems through the financial network that came about as a rise of the Rothschild Empire. But, as I've told you before in this broadcast, as I've told you privately, as I've told so many people, that for many years my political outlook, and I do focus on the, I focus on the secular in my writings, but I came to realize, oh, I've been in this business, I guess now, writing and speaking and talking, for about 30 years, all told, maybe a little more, maybe slightly less, but it wasn't until about halfway into it that I realized that although I write about these very secular things here, that this battle is actually one of a higher spiritual level.
Mm.
And while we have people who, and I will use this term loosely, while we have people who appear to be human beings and probably are human beings, you know, of all races, creeds, and colors operating on this planet, ultimately the evil goes back to the beginning of it all. It is good versus evil. It is God versus Satan, to put it down in a very specific, easy-to-grasp framework. But this battle is fought out here on planet Earth by people led by the Rothschilds, and not to villainize these people, although I do believe they are villains, but if you want to put a face on the villainy, you can say Lord Jacob Rothschild. He may be one of the nicest people you would ever meet. And while there may be other people on the other side who are not some of the nicest people you would ever want to meet, ultimately the battle is a very spiritual battle. It's fought with machine guns, it's fought with money, it's fought with political intrigue, but ultimately it's a spiritual battle between God and Satan.
I'm glad you clarified that, Michael, because, you know, we have the story of Babylon. In history, in the book of Genesis in the Bible, tells us that there they sought to form a new world order. But they also sought to make man as God. In other words, they built a tower to the heavens so that man would ascend to godhood. So we have all the elements that we have now with the Jews, who claim racial and spiritual superiority, who claim to be the kings of the world over all of the Gentiles. And they're building a new world order too. So it is, and they were trained all of those decades during captivity, where they actually prospered and flourished and were allowed peacefully to go back to reform the nation of Israel. I might mention too, one of the things you said, if people doubt it, wherever they were at in these countries and claimed persecution, and even when they left, they took their money with them. For example, we know when they left Egypt, there they were in the desert. They turned from God, even though God had given them so many miracles, the parting of the Red Sea and so forth, and they began to go a-whoring after the old Egyptian gods. They had adopted the Egyptian gods, one of which the golden calf represented. How did they build the golden calf? Well, Aaron told them, bring me all of your golden jewelry, your earrings, your bracelets, and so forth. They brought the gold out of Egypt. And then in the desert there, they betrayed God and created a great golden idol. They didn't make it out of sand. They didn't make it out of rock or wood. It was out of gold. So they brought their riches out of Egypt with them. And it may have been that the Pharaoh wanted the riches back rather than the people. It's just possible. Hey, Michael, we're going to go for a short break.
All right.
When we come back, I want to ask you some more about Rothschild, but particularly, is this Jewish elite, these rich, the Rothschilds and the others, are they digging a grave for America and its citizens? That is of supreme importance. Folks, stay with us. My guest, Michael Collins Piper, author of one of the most important books you will ever read, The New Babylon. We'll be right back. The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme. You know, right inside the cover of this great book by Michael Collins Piper, It says the Rothschild Empire, the modern day Pharisees, and the historical, religious, and economic origins of the New World Order. A lot of people talk about the New World Order, but, you know, they really don't know anything about it, or they're too frightened and fearful to tell you who really is behind it. And some of these people have very popular talk shows, even patriot talk shows. And I have great pity for them. You know, I pity any person who is fearful. And would you listen to this? In the book of Revelation, it has a list of people who will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And oh, there's adulterers, warmongers, murderers, liars. I mean, it's a horrible list. I don't want to be any of those things. Blasphemers. None of them will enter the kingdom of heaven. But guess what leads the list? The fearful. The fearful will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Isn't that amazing? You would say, well, I feel sorry for the timid and the cowardly and the weak. Why wouldn't God accept them? Here's the reason why. God, if you're truthful, if you depend on Him, He will give you the strength to be an overcomer and defeat evil. If you do not have faith and do not trust in God, then you will be filled with fear of the evildoer. This is an important principle. Courage. To have courage. And by the way, I'm not going to preach a sermon here because I want to get back to Michael Collins Piper. If you don't have enough courage, if you are fearful, the wonderful thing is you can ask God for more courage, for more strength. And He is good and just and merciful, and He will give you more. I've done that many times. Every once in a while, the little fear darts, you know, will ping, ping, right in Tex Moore's there. And I just say, wait just a minute. I'm not going to be fearful. I'm not going to betray God. And He promised me certain things. And I said, Lord, take away this fear. And it has always been so that God took it away from me. Now back to this book. You need to know these things and you need to go out and tell others. I'm going to encourage you. I don't think I've really done this in a long, long time, but I encourage you to buy a copy of this book, The New Babylon, but buy an extra copy you can give to a friend or a loved one. Buy two copies. And I'm not just trying to sell books. I want you to know the truth. And as far as I know, right at this time in history, this is really the only book that has put it all together. Michael Collins Piper is an academic. He's a scholarly man, but he writes so that everybody can understand him, you know, no matter what your grade is, level. But it's around 266 pages in all. And it's just powerful. It's all kind of facts, documentation. And he takes you step by step into the labyrinth, way into the inner sanctum of the Illuminati and the Rothschilds. And I think it's like 5 or 10 books in one. I highly recommend it. Now, Jerry's my broadcast engineer, a little bit of everything here. What are we offering this book in the ministry? $25? All right, $25. And by the way, you get a big picture of Michael Collins Piper on the back cover, sitting in a regal chair there. So if you want to know what Michael looks like, hey, now you're going to know. Okay? Some of you might be interested in that. But I think the information in this book is even more powerful. But hey, Michael, you look pretty good here, actually.
We had to take about 50 pictures before.
Well, the photographer finally came out good.
Thank goodness for digital cameras. In the old days, you know, you had to take all the pictures and send them off to the local drugstore and get them developed. But now you have the digital camera and you can take 50 or 100 pictures and find the best one and just develop that one.
Well, that's great. Well, you did on this one, and I'm glad. People like to know who is writing the book sometimes, so it's important. Okay, now, folks, $25. Please add $5 shipping and handling. Now, here's how to get this book. Just phone us toll-free during the work week, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5:30 Central Time. And our number is 1-800-234-9673. That's in the United States and Canada. If you're overseas, of course, it's area code 512-263-9780. Now, here's another way to do it. Go to powerofprophecy.com. And you can order the book there on our list of books. We have a little search engine. Type in the word Babylon. I suspect this book will come up. And then you can order it that way. Okay? on powerofprophecy.com. And a third way, all you have to do is just write us. Put a little note or a stick-it note or a piece of scrap paper and say, hey, I want the new Babylon. Michael Collins Piper. Three names, that's a lot, but just say, hey, I want the new Babylon, and we'll know that it's Michael Collins Piper's book. So the new Babylon, those who reign supreme. Our address, 1708 Patterson Road. Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, P-A-T-T-E-R-S-O-N Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. If you're overseas at USA, please, even though this is a Republic of Texas, don't put that on there. They will simply not understand. Jerry, how long have we been at this address? We've been here a long time, haven't we? 18 years, yeah, at the same address. That's sort of unusual. You know, I'm surprised they haven't burned us down or, you know, sent a missile our way or something. But we're still here, and we're going to be here until Judgment Day, or God has his say. Now we're going to return to our regular program. My good friend Michael Collins Piper is on with us today, and we're talking about the Rothschild Empire, the New Babylon. And, Michael, I'm concerned about something. You mentioned the Jewish utopia, and you said that the Jews have been in all these countries, and many, they claim persecution, but their evil ways has caused them to be banished and so forth. Now, in those countries where the Jews were able to gain a foothold and actually to conquer the resident government, and I've been thinking back on those. Now, you probably have a better mind than this. I know they were able for a short time to gain power in Turkey during the days of the Young Turks. And they converted that into a massacre of all the Christians of Armenia. That was a province of Turkey. So when the Jews, you know, crypto-Jews claiming to be Turks, took over about 1915 in Turkey, they immediately used the Turkey army to go and to massacre and kill Christians. It's called the Armenian Genocide. Then in 1917, and you've written all about this, but you and I know that it was Jews, Lenin and Trotsky and the others, Kaganovich, that took over the Soviet empire of the Tsars, and then they used that into a killing factory to kill, according to Alexander Solzhenitsyn, 66 million mostly Christian people. So in every country they've been able to gain a foothold in, it's resulted in the massacre of millions of Christians. Now, is their goal to take over the whole world then?
You know, that's the sorry thing. This is what has been stated in their own writings. And you know, Tex, during the break here, I just happened to come across an article from the New York Times, which is a perfect segue into this discussion. It was in the New York Times on November 19th, and it talks about Rabbi Steinsaltz. He is the guy who is basically known in our modern day. He's the guy who pretty much has put out the version of the Talmud, which is like the kind of the popular version of the Talmud, this base of Jewish rabbinic teachings and debates from which modern day Jewish philosophy, ideology, the rules of existence, for want of a better way of putting it, are founded. And, you know, here in the New York Times, Rabbi Steinsaltz says, this book is essential for our existence. Now, let me read you further from the New York Times. It says, the Talmud, a compilation and analysis of oral Jewish law and ethics governing everything from marital relations to agriculture, is written as a flowing rabbinic discourse. Though the terms are archaic, many say the Talmud contains founding principles that can still be applied today. Well, why is that important? It is important because in these Talmudic teachings, there is very clearly outlined an ultimate goal of a Jewish utopia, as one Jewish writer has defined it. That is a world in which the riches of the planet, the political power, the entire governance falls into the hands of the Jewish people. Now, this does not mean for some of our more sensitive listeners, and there are a few out there who might be a little I don't know, perturbed by what we're talking about. This does not mean to suggest. I don't mean to suggest it, and I know you don't mean to suggest it. And I would go so far as to put words in your mouth there. This is not to suggest that the nice Jewish businessman who has the shoe shop on the corner is sitting up nightly reading the Talmud, plotting to take over the world. No, we are not saying that. What we are saying, and in this case I will say what I am saying, is that the Talmud has become a foundation for a very powerful group of people who are Jews, who do believe in its teachings, who are steeped in its thought, who have used it as a framework to achieve power and influence in all of the great countries of the world, whether today or at one time in their history. And through their consolidation of the power, they have worked to achieve a global unity among themselves. And in the course of this, what has happened is that for the most part, we could say the entirety of the worldwide Jewish community has been dragged into this with them. Now, in my existence, I have known some of the most outspoken critics of this concept we call Zionism, Jewish critics of Zionism. There are a lot of Jewish people who are critics of Israel, but there have been some very eminent critics of Zionism and among the Jewish people, and some of them have been very good friends of mine. I can go through the list of the late Jack Bernstein, the late Dr. Alfred Lilienthal, Mark Lane, the civil libertarian lawyer who represented my old newspaper, The Spotlight, for many years. And there are other many, many people, Jewish people around the world, who object to the intrigues of this architectural construct that surrounds the global Rothschild Empire. But the problem is there are so many Jewish people who are unaware of it, or who basically allow themselves to support it by not speaking out. And that's one of the problems. That's why when we use the term the Jews, referring to, shall we say, the people who call themselves Jews, and there are many who would debate the identity of who the Jews are today, even including the Jews themselves, but when we use that term, the Jews, we don't necessarily mean that every single one of them is involved in some conspiracy, some plan, some network. But the unfortunate thing is, so many of them have been brought into it. And I guess I look at my job as to try to just tell the facts about this thing as I see it, and to mix metaphors here, I guess let the chips fall where they may. I've been called anti-Semitic so many times that I don't even argue the point anymore, for the simple reason that these definitions of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism essentially will mean to people whatever they want it to mean. And people can argue till they're blue in the face, till the cock crows at dawn, you know. But the problem is, we get into these linguistic debates and we get sidetracked from the very purpose of trying to stop this, I'll just call it what it is, an evil conspiracy. And it's an evil conspiracy stemming back to Babylon, crafted in the minds of the rabbis in this thing called the Talmud, which is the philosophical foundation for this much bigger financial, political, and I might add military and media network that we do call the New World Order today.
So, you know, you talk about the importance of the Talmud. In your book, I want to point it out, in the first several pages, on the left side here, you have a picture of the Rothschild family, the five arrows, so to speak, including Meir. On the right, you quote a number of authorities, including Jews, about the Rothschilds, and you quote S.J. Cohen. And he wrote evidently a biography of Meir Amschel Rothschild. And you added this in your book, and I'm glad you did. Cohen, of course, who's Jewish. And by the way, the title of the biography is The Exemplary Life of the Immortal Banker, Mr. Meir Amschel Rothschild. But he says Meir Rothschild was a zealous believer in the Talmud and chose it alone as the guiding principle of all of his actions. Now, if the Rothschilds are such an important dynasty that perhaps, and I'm going to be asking this question in a moment, do they control the Fed Reserve? Do they control most of the banks of the world? Do they basically almost run America behind the scenes? Then if they have a book called the Talmud, this holy book, which it alone continues to be their guiding principle for all their actions, should we not learn more about the Talmud and its meaning, because it's going to affect our daily lives?
Absolutely. The answer to all of that is yes, 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 yes. I mean, the Talmud is a mystery to everyone, I suppose, even including to those rabbis and those students of the Talmud that spend so many endless hours studying it. But we cannot avoid, it's like people, I've actually heard people say, and good people, good patriots say, well, the Rothschilds really aren't Jews. Well, no, the Rothschilds are Jews in the sense that they belong genetically to a long line of intermarried families who considered themselves to be Jews and followers of the Jewish religion, and who were considered by others to be Jews. But more so, more importantly, the Rothschilds have historically, beginning with Meyer Rothschild, the founder of the dynasty, they have been devoted to the Jewish philosophy of the Talmud. And Meyer Rothschild himself was a rabbi. He was not an apostate rabbi. You know, and a lot of people don't realize this. While there are a lot of ministers, Christian ministers, who have gone through a theological seminary and use the title reverend, and while there are Catholic priests who have gone through the Catholic seminaries and call themselves, you know, Father so-and-so, Father O'Reilly, Father O'Sullivan, many times there are Jews who have gone through the Talmudic study, and there are many of them who are entitled to be called rabbi, but they don't necessarily head a congregation. It would have been accurate to call Meyer Rothschild Rabbi Rothschild, even though he was, by profession, he was a moneylender, but he in fact was entitled to be called rabbi. Now that's probably, on the one hand, a minor point, but on the other hand, I think it's a significant point, because it does point back to this necessity of understanding that what we call the New World Order, as it operates in the sphere of this Rothschild dynasty, does have its roots in these rabbinic teachings known as the Talmud. And yet you really just can't get away from that. That's the problem here, I see. And a lot of people, and understandably so, are afraid of being called anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish or anti-Zionist or what have you. And so therefore they like to try to avoid bringing a religious aspect into it. But, you know, the thing is, when we are dealing with this very hard reality of what the New World Order constitutes, you can't fight the New World Order unless you identify its agents here before us on American soil, on the face of the planet Earth. And if you can't identify those people without pointing out what is philosophically driving them, then you kind of fall into a little bit of a quagmire. You know, it'd be like going out on the battlefield with a face mask on. You know, with a mask around your eyes. You know, you can't fight the war without knowing who the enemy is.
Well, you know, Michael, I was in the Air Force, and I can imagine being shot down, you know, or something, wounded, about ready to die, and they say, would you like to see a chaplain? And I said, yes. So a chaplain comes up, and I say, I would like to pray because I'm fixing to die, okay? And he says, okay. And he begins by saying, oh, my Lord Satan. And I said, well, hold it just a minute. I'm fixing to die, and you're praying for Satan. He says, well, I'm a satanic chaplain. I'm of the Church of Satan. I was ordained. The Air Force has made me a chaplain. Well, if he has no label, if I don't know what he has, but I'll tell you, in the Air Force, Jewish chaplains had the little Ten Commandments thing here, okay? Like the Mosaic Code on their suit coat. And Christian chaplains, guess what? They had a cross on their uniform, so you could tell the difference. If you can't tell the difference, then religion and culture and society mean nothing. But it does.
You know, that's a, thank you for that, Tex. That's a very absolutely interesting analogy, and it absolutely drives home the point here. You know, that brings up something I wanted to mention. It's a very personal story, but it's a story that confirmed to me what I had long suspected from my, and I would have to say, I probably read more about Jewish history and religion and teachings than probably 99.9% of the people, but I would be the last person to ever proclaim myself an expert in the topic. But one time, I was having a conversation with a Jewish friend of mine, a guy I've known around Capitol Hill for years. I run into him. People know, everybody knows him, and he knows everybody. Capitol Hill is like a small town in many respects. And he knew that I worked for Liberty Lobby, and he knew that I was a critic of Israel and that I've been openly critic of Jewish power. And, you know, he's kind of intrigued to see that, hey, well, this guy Mike Piper's a nice guy. So I would have some very candid conversations with him about this. And one time I said to him, I said, let me ask you a question. I said, how would you describe Judaism as a religion to me in several words? And without missing a beat and not being facetious in the least, he said to me, self-worship.
Self-worship.
Now, I was, on the one hand, absolutely flabbergasted that he had said it, but it was a confirmation to me of what I had come to perceive as the underlying nature of the Jewish faith. And, of course, as any Christian knows, no matter, you know, the least educated Christian in terms of biblical reading would know immediately that that is as far from Christianity as you can get. I mean, you know, and I said to him when he said this self-worship, I said to him, I said, well, I said, that's interesting. Fair enough. I said, that's always been my impression. Well, there's a little punchline to this story. Several months later, I see this guy once every 6, 8, 10 weeks, you know, run into him on the street. And Maybe a couple months later, ran into him, and we're walking down the street, happened to be going in the same direction. And I said to him, I said, you know, I said, I asked you one time what Judaism was, and you said self-worship. And he did a double take and looked at me, and he said, did I say that? And I laughed.
Well, that was pretty Judaic and Talmudic right there, to deny what he had said.
And I said, well, yes, you did. And I said, it was a perfectly honest answer. And he said, did I say that? And I said, did I say that? I didn't say that. And I said, oh, no, you said it. And I said, you confirmed everything that I had always suspected. So if you put that little simple, but I think revealing anecdote, and I like anecdotes because they often tell you a lot. If you put that little anecdote in the context of this bigger picture that I have written about in the New Babylon, and which, of course, many others have written about in one form or another, what we do indeed find is that this thing we know of as Judaism, this thing that is followed by people who call themselves Jews, is a philosophy of self-worship, a philosophy of self-enrichment. And I guess, and we'll get into a little psychobabble here. I guess what it all comes down to, sadly, is that once a people have spent 1,000 years or 500 years or even 100 years preaching to themselves and indirectly to anyone who will listen that they are truly God's chosen people, that their philosophy is the philosophy of the ages, that they are the ones who are going to inherit the earth, and it's their right to do it, and that they should pursue every means of achieving that end, well then, you know what? They are going to follow through and try to achieve just that. And it is their utopia. It's their new world order, but it's a global plantation, as Willis Cardo has coined the term, I thought correctly. It's a global plantation for the rest of us.
Well, you know, you mentioned self-worship, and you and I know that the Encyclopedia Judaica says that the word Messiah is a metaphor in Judaism, a metaphor for collective godhood.
Exactly. That's a point.
In other words, the Jews are their own Messiah. They collectively are Christ.
That's right. The Jewish people are the Messiah. There's a lot of well-meaning Christian folks and others who are standing on the sidelines who interpret the concept of the Jewish Messiah as being, well, to put it as probably at the lowest common denominator what people think, they think that the Jewish people are waiting for Jesus.
Oh my goodness gracious. They're waiting for when they can be their own Messiah, when they have such control over the world. That they can rule us with a rod of iron. But here's the question. We only have 3 minutes left. I've got to have this answer from you. If the Jews have caused such horror and damage in every nation that they've gained control of, whether it's in Turkey for a short period of time, the Soviet Union during the communist era, or are they on the verge? We only have about 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Or are they on the verge of achieving that goal in the United States, which could, of course, then be the tool they used to grab the rest of the world? And if they do, what is going to happen to you and me and every listener out there who believes in Christ or who simply doesn't want to go along with the Jewish utopia?
Well, you know, they literally talk about a period in the Talmud and other Jewish writings, they talk about the enslavement or the destruction of those who don't go along with it. Those who go along with it, they will be treated benevolently to the extent that anyone who runs a plantation is benevolent. But those who stand in the way, they, in their writings, this is their writings, not mine, they talk of stomping out. They don't use that terminology, but that's what they're talking about. And, I'll tell you what, Tex, it looks bleak at times, but, you know, we may lose quite a few battles, but ultimately, in the end, we do know who is going to win, and it's not Satan.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, the Bible says very clearly, talks about them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. And God says to the Christians that they should know that someday those people, the synagogue of Satan, will come bow at your feet and admit that Jesus Christ is Lord. And there we have prophecy in the book of Revelation. And by the way, Michael, as you well know, the book of Revelation doesn't mention the Islamic mosque or the Buddhist temples or any other religion as being Satan's choice to control the world in the last days, but it only mentions there in prophecy the synagogue of Satan. So God identifies our enemy, and I think that settles it. Hey, Michael. It's been so great to be with you today.
Yeah, Tex, I appreciate it. And, you know, I just want to mention one more thing for the benefit of your listeners. If they haven't had the opportunity to meet the fine people that work for you, I just was actually writing about you guys the other day in a new book that I'm working on. And I just want people to know that you have assembled around you some really fine people. And it's been a pleasure to know them and to work with them, along with you and Wanda.
Well, Michael, that's very kind of you.
I
feel the same way about you, having met so many of you all, folks. I could name them all off. We're running out of time here. But that's very kind of you, and I appreciate it. And we do want to be of service to people. We want to be of service to American Free Press, because I've gained so much knowledge over the years from your publication. Hey, Michael Collins Piper, God bless you, my friend.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tex. God bless you.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Power of Prophecy. I'm Tex Mars. My guest has been Michael Collins Piper. The book, The New Babylon, you must have it. And my prayer is that you'll tune in each week during this same time and discover the power of prophecy.